Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. One party rule. It's the norm in Columbus City government and has been for a long time. Today we're going to talk about how and when it changed over to complete Democratic control. We'll hear from the spokesperson for Columbus Coalition for Responsive Government about their plan for change, and we'll hear about similar trends in cities across the country. Joining us now is Joe Hallett. He's senior editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Joe started his reporting career in Columbus in 1985. He covered state government and politics for the Toledo Blade, but you couldn't live in Central Ohio and cover state politics without knowing the lay of the land at City Hall in Columbus. So welcome to the show, Joe.
Thanks, Ann. Always good to be here.
When you arrived in Columbus in 1985, was it a Republican city?
Yeah. As I recall, Buck Reinhart, Dana Reinhart, was the mayor. Mm-hmm. And gosh, my memory fails me a little bit, but I know there were Republicans on council. It was a split body, which is different than it is now, obviously. But Republican mayor. There had been quite a long line of Republican mayors. This used to be a Republican county, as you know. Now it's flipped to a pretty solidly blue county. The city council was divided partisanly. Now it's, you know, all Democrats, which is typical of, I think, almost all of the major cities in Ohio, with the exception of Cincinnati. They just had three Republicans elected to their council down there, which was, some would say, not unusual, because Cincinnati and Hamilton County used to be pretty solidly Republican.
Right.
But it has become a blue county, particularly after the 2008 election when Obama was the first Democrat to win Hamilton County in 41 years.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about one-party government. It's not only in the city council, it's also in the Franklin County Board of Commissioners, County Board of Commissioners. What do you make of one-party rule in a city like Columbus that dominates a county like Franklin? You can give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, as I said, Franklin County is also dominated by Democrats, solidly Democratic across the board. When you arrived, like I said, in 1985, the first of three Republican mayors had just left office, Tom Moody, replaced by GOP Mayor Dana Reinhart, known as Buck. Columbus wasn't what it is today. Was it still big enough to have that urban core, though? How did Republicans get the foothold they had, or what changed?
Well, I think partly is that a lot of the Republicans, like in many major urban areas, moved to the suburbs and out of the city.
Voters.
Yeah, it's Republican voters. So I think the core of the party was kind of eviscerated here in the city and eventually in the county. We've seen, you know, these ex-urban counties around Columbus and Franklin County grow so mightily, particularly Delaware County, as Franklin County and the city of Columbus became less Republican, those out counties became more Republican, and now, as you know, it's pretty difficult for a Republican to win in Franklin County. As we were talking before the show, I'm of the opinion that the smaller the governmental unit, the less partisanship plays. I know I covered a little town that I grew up in my first 9 years of being a reporter, and it was an all-Republican city council. But I never got the feeling that they made decisions based on partisanship, primarily because they knew everybody in town. People had more direct access to their representatives or their city council members.
But there's a difference between the size of the political entity and the size of the political subdivision. Mm-hmm. And Wauseon was a small town, too, and it had a small political entity governing it. This is a small political entity governing it, just six and a mayor. But the town, my gosh, since 1989 when I arrived here, is huge compared to what it once was.
Oh,
I think
yeah,
it was
it's
a half
exploded.
A million back then, and the metro area is easily a million now. The city's 750 or something like that.
Yeah.
So the city's actually grown in size.
It has. It's remarkable. I mean, when I arrived in 85, and I don't want to be too derogatory about it, but everybody called Columbus a cow town, and it kind of was. It just wasn't as cosmopolitan, you know, and as diverse as it is now. And I think a lot of things happened that made that possible. I think frankly, I think the governance in this city has been pretty good, you know, under both Republican and Democratic mayors. We have a very active business community in this city. And I think that mayors of both parties, including Mayor Coleman, the Democrat, has learned that it is beneficial for him politically and for the city economically and otherwise to cooperate with that business community. It's not kind of the typical or the stereotypical kind of Democratic mayor who, you know, union first, you know, I need the union vote and to get elected. This mayor, I think, as well as the Republican mayors, work pretty well with the business community. And overall, I think even with the employee unions.
The way it may not be called a machine. Some people view it as a machine, though, now since the 70s, I think, 1973 or 1975, voters approved on the ballot a rule that said that when there's a vacancy on city council, whoever is appointed to replace to fill that vacancy must also run for election for that seat as well. And that's created that's played a role in the solidarity of the Democrats on city council, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, we have council members who owe their positions to somebody else, a lot of them to the mayor, a lot of them to the party, because they were appointed initially. And
all of them now.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, ultimately, they have to face the voters.
But they do so with a distinct advantage.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Republican Party now, I think, has, because it's become such a Democratic city, has had trouble finding really strong candidates. I think they have had some. But, you know, the advantages politically and fundraising-wise, you know, are just overwhelmingly with the Democrats right now in this city. And it's hard to see that it won't remain a Democratic-controlled city for years into the future because of the inherent Democratic advantage now.
And it not only be Democratic, but it'll be the Democrats that are picked by the Democrats who are sitting.
Exactly. It's kind of incestuous. I mean, they just, but again, it's hard to decry one-party rule at this juncture in the city because it's my feeling that government has worked pretty well here. I mean, there probably will be some disagreement out there from your listeners, but this city, I covered Cleveland for a while. I was a political reporter for the Plain Dealer for a while. And I always said that covering politics in Cleveland was a lot more fun than it was here because it was all Democrats, but they didn't get along. They were elected from wards. They had more parochial interests. They wanted to take care of their wards first, the city second. I think that's different. Now, we have the members of city council here in Columbus are elected at large. I think they have to have the interests of the city as a whole in mind. And I frankly think that is a better way to go.
Some cities like Columbus have a combination. They have a ward system with some at-large members that do represent the entire city. And there is a big difference in similar-sized cities. Let's just take, you know, what we're often compared to is Indianapolis. And the citizens per member represented on the council in Columbus are 112,000, or more than 112,000. And in Indianapolis, it's 28,000, over 28,000 per member.
Mm-hmm.
There, it seems like that's more of that direct access. There's more direct access to your representative in a place like that, more like Wauseon, where you came from, than 112,000. How do you stack up when it comes to that, those kind of numbers?
Yeah. Actually, I think that Indianapolis, and I may be mistaken, has a metro form of government. And
In other words, not a strong. Oh, that's right, a metro. That's right.
I think the county and the city government are combined.
Okay.
A lot of it seems to work pretty well for Indianapolis and whatever county it's in,
mm-hmm.
Because I think it is like Columbus, a pretty well governed city. They obviously have more representatives or more council members on their metro government than Columbus does. And I think that's an admirable goal to try and get the ratio between representatives or council members and citizens as small as you can. But, you know, it's also a matter of what you can afford. I know I'm not sure what our city council members get paid here. I don't think it's a lot. But, you know, a smaller government typically is a less expensive government. And the citizens here have been pretty good about supporting their city government. I mean, we've seen income tax levy approved here. It's a progressive city, and even though it's an all Democratic government, I don't cover city council day to day, but it doesn't look like there are a lot of decisions made on the basis of partisanship. I mean,
back when Buck Reinhart ran, was mayor, there were Republicans and Democrats on city council back then. Did you notice any particular problems running city government when there was the diversity?
None that come to mind. I'm sure that there were. Both parties are trying to get a leg up on each other, whether it is in the city government or the state legislature or Congress. Typically between the two parties, you see a difference in philosophy. We're especially seeing that now with Republicans having to answer so much to the Tea Party. I live in Westerville, and I know that there were several Tea Party members running for the school board there. They were all defeated. The citizens of the school district decided they didn't want to go the Tea Party route. That, you know, they made pretty clear what their governing philosophy was for the schools, and that was to manage the district with less funds and make cuts here or there wherever they can. And I think that the voters in Westerville decided that we made a pretty significant investment in the schools here, and we really don't want to jeopardize it now. We don't want somebody coming in and making significant cuts here. So I think there is today quite a different governing philosophy between the two parties. For a lot of reasons, I think primarily because of gerrymandering on the state level, that hasn't happened in the city. We are seeing both parties move further to their extremes.
My guest is Joe Hallett, senior editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, Jonathan Beard, spokesperson for the Columbus Coalition for Responsive Government. They have some ideas about how to change things in City Hall. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. One party rule. It's the norm in Columbus City government now and has been for a long time. Today we're talking about how and when it changed over to complete Democratic control, and not just Democratic control, but Democratic control within an arm of the Democratic Party. Coming up, we'll hear about similar trends across the country. Still with us is Joe Hallett, senior editor for the Columbus Dispatch. We looked back with Joe back in the days when Republicans at least shared some of the power in city government. Joining us now is Jonathan Beard. He's a spokesperson for the Columbus Coalition for Responsive Government, which wants to, among other things, change how much campaigns spend on races for Columbus City Council and mayor. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you. Good to be here, Ann.
So you've put forth an initiative. It's called Dare to Be Fair, which includes the plan for spending limits. Why are spending limits important in city council and mayoral races?
You and Joe talked about the fact that Columbus has switched to an all-Democratic environment. Franklin County is fast going the same way. And really, voters deserve fair and competitive elections. You know, our democracy is founded on the fact that there's a competition of ideas in the marketplace, and we're not seeing that right now. So one of the things we're looking for is ways to introduce competition into an environment where everybody's philosophically aligned, at least in principle, and then also accountability so that people are actually judged by their performance in office and that, you know, just being a loyal party Democrat doesn't get you appointed and doesn't get you party support. So the idea is, you know, let's make sure our elections stay competitive. Let's make sure they stay fair. When you look at it right now, that Joe talked about the disparities in money, and they're absolutely phenomenal. I think this last election, the Democrats raised and spent $375,000 to $16,000 for Republicans. That's not a competitive election. That's not a fair election across 225 square miles and 800,000 people. And we've got to do something to restore balance in the election.
Spending limits have been put down because they are considered unconstitutional. It's the free expression. You should be able to spend as much money as you want on a candidate. You should be able to raise as much money as you can for a candidate. How would that change, ultimately, anything? The Democrats, as far as I know, didn't necessarily spend all the money they raised. They didn't have to.
Yeah. What we've done is we've sponsored a citizen-initiated ordinance. So under the city charter, citizens can propose legislation. Back in 1994, under Issue 6, the voters actually approved a charter amendment to allow campaign finance reform because it was such a big issue at all levels of government. The state passed campaign finance reform about that time frame, and the citizens authorized it, but council never enacted a law to put it into effect. So what we've done is we looked across the city, across the country, at other at-large cities. You know, these at-large elections, citywide elections, are very expensive elections, a lot more expensive than district elections, which make them non-competitive. And what we did is adopt a law out of Austin, looked at Austin's law. They were formerly all at-large, and last election they went to districts.
Okay.
And it's a voluntary program where candidates can opt into contribution and expenditure limits. And in exchange for agreeing to those limits, then they get a host of public benefits designed to get better information to the voters and designed to reduce the cost of running for election. So the idea is, as voters, we deserve more than the 30-second soundbite that says you support, you know, police, fire, safe neighborhoods, and good jobs. Everybody supports that. But let's get a little further into the issues, and let's really see, you know, what the differences are between the candidates and how they would perform their jobs.
Let's go to something that Joe said earlier. The city seems to be very well run, and voters gave it the ultimate stamp of approval a few years ago when they supported an income tax increase in the middle, well, at the height of a recession.
Sure.
Here and around the rest of the country, what are we not getting from city government that we would be getting if there was more access to it?
I think Columbus is a great city. The residents are great. I've lived in other places, and this is a place where people care about their neighbors and you know, we know we're going to be here for a while. This isn't a city where people are in and out every 4 years with an election cycle. So we do have a commitment to each other. We have proven that many times. We've got the third highest tax burden in the country. So Columbus voters have been very generous. At the same time, we are in a representative democracy, and our representatives should reflect our views. I think if you look at issue 5051, for instance, which is the most visible
levy issues,
the most visible recent example of how disconnected the politicians are from the people. So this is something that was supported 100% by the politicians, but the voters trounced it at the polls. I always say you get 30% at the polls just for showing up and putting your name on the ballot. And this issue got 31%, so they didn't do much better than that. So if you look at that, that's a big policy issue. 95% of what city government does is non-controversial. It's buying uniforms for police and fire. It's, you know, making sure there are chemicals in the water plants. But it's at 5% where there is some discretion, some difference from the voters. The other thing is, as citizens, we've got a responsibility to manage our democracy. We would like to believe that the people we elect are good caretakers of our democracy. And we do trust them when we turn our backs and go about our lives. But at the same time, we can't walk away. And we have an election cycle, 2011, 2013, the last two municipal elections, where one person contributes 78% of the dollars that's spent to elect candidates. And this is Friends for Ginther PAC. We would not tolerate that at the federal level. As Democrats, I'm a Democrat. We have all kinds of issues with Citizens United and kind of the unlimited PAC spending. Why should we tolerate that at the local level? It looks wrong in so many ways, especially when you get these issues like 5051, where the council president, proposed this issue.
Which is Andrew Ginther, by the way.
Yeah, proposed the issue, and all the council members were in support of it, but the voters were not. And it just leaves the impression that not only did he appoint them to office, but then he put all the money into their campaign. 62% of Eileen Paley's campaign, 72% of Priscilla Tyson's, and 90% of Pro Tem President Miller.
And those are the three people who ran for ran for election this past cycles. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Jonathan Beard, a spokesperson for the Columbus Coalition for Responsive Government. They put forth an initiative. It's called Dare to Be Fair, and we were just talking about their proposed spending limits. If you have a question or comment about that, you can give us a call at 614-292-8513. Let's talk about the issue of ward representation. That's one of three other planks to the initiative.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So Columbus has an all-at-large form of government. It was put in place with a charter amendment in 1914 as part of really a nationwide effort where the big business, the Fords and the Rockefellers and the Carnegies, were essentially trying to gain control over cities. It was part of what was called the Progressive Reform Movement. Columbus was one of the cities that went all at large. We formerly had 19 districts at the time that we switched. Since then, almost every city has moved back to districts. So of the 50 largest cities in America, 49 of them now, the voters have moved back to districts. About 3 years ago, Detroit moved back. This election, actually, they elected their first district council members in 100 years. Austin last year in their election voted to go to districts, and then Seattle, which was the only remaining at-large system, went back to districts in this most recent election. So Columbus is the only big 50 city that has an all-at-large form of government. The problem with the all-at-large form of government is that it is a system designed to emulate the big business of the early 1900s, which is command and control type business. And you do have a very powerful influence of business on a few people who are in city government. So we've got a small 7-member council, all of whom are elected at large, only one of whom can afford their own election. And so, you know, we've got to be wary of kind of how money controls policy.
Joe Hallett, you think that that's okay? You think that that's resulted in good governing, at least in Columbus?
Yeah, I think, as I said before, I think this city, generally speaking, is pretty well run. It's a city that works. As I said, having been a political reporter for the Plain Dealer, I saw the Cleveland City Council, which was I think there are 21 members representing wards and all Democrats, and they fought like cats and dogs. And
is that such a bad thing, though, necessarily?
Probably not. I mean,
you said it was more fun to cover,
depends on motivation.
Mm-hmm.
They had, as I mentioned, I think more parochial interests of their districts. Which, you know, maybe it isn't all bad, but you would hope that they have a view of the welfare of the city at large.
At large, right. John Beard, what about that aspect
sure.
of it? That and Columbus has been able to make great strides by being unified.
And I'll talk to you as somebody born and raised in Cleveland.
Okay.
When we had 33 council members when I was growing up. But we've got two completely different cities. We've got Cleveland, which went through the steel mill collapse, which went through the deindustrialization of America, which was shrinking. The pie was getting smaller and smaller. And we've got Columbus, which back in the 1950s, under a Republican administration, actually, developed a water and sewer and annexation policy that allowed the city's boundaries to grow and allowed the city's population to grow. So we weren't landlocked by suburbs, but our tax base continued to grow. And we've done very well with that policy in place that every administration has since supported. So we're really talking apples and oranges. Cleveland's council was way too big. 33 members for what might have been 600,000 population. Now it's 450,000 and 21 members. So I think there's a common sense, reasonable background. You know, people are going to fight like cats and dogs when the pie is shrinking. Here, what we'd like to do is get to a reasonable level of governance. What we're proposing is an 11-member council, which has really been discussed since the 1950s. There were efforts by city government to make these changes from the 1950s on. 11-member council, 4 members at large, and 7 members who would be elected in the districts in which they live. So it's a type of contemporary governance form that's practiced by really most every place across the country, which allows for the representation and the those who say that at-large members have citywide perspective.
Jonathan, this isn't a Republican versus Democratic issue.
That's right.
This
yeah.
is more of a Democratic
That's
versus
exactly
Democrat,
right.
Democrat versus Democrat issue.
Yeah.
It's unlikely, all things being equal, a Republican's going to get elected
That's
in this urban center now. But it's the same Democrats from the same bolt of cloth is what you're troubled by.
Yeah, and you know, I think recognizing that Columbus will become more and more Democratic, probably, what we've got to do as Democrats is say, we still need these things in our election, like competition and accountability. And so maybe it's moving these things up towards the primary, although we're non-partisan elections, but move them up to the so that other Democrats feel like they can realistically challenge an incumbent and win, and not just be a sacrificial lamb at the altar of campaign spending.
Mark in Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Good morning. Years ago when Fred Andley was on the air, and he had interviewed Studs Terkel, and I got to talk with Studs Terkel about this issue, and his view on the at-large system was that the citizens of Columbus were basically being robbed of any effective representation on city council, unless our city council members actually live in the neighborhoods representing, how can they represent the interests of the citizens of Columbus?
So you're for that ward-style system?
Absolutely.
Well, is there something about the way Columbus has been run that you think has been unsatisfactory?
It's just as your one guest said, that there are too few people on council being influenced by too much money on one hand, and the average citizens of Columbus are just being kind of left out in the cold.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Mark.
I'll tell you to his point.
John Beard?
I got interested in the district representation when we were having problems on East Main Street and we were having drug-related gun violence and could not get a response from city council. We got completely ignored and dismissed. And, you know, I was sitting there scratching my head. You know, we had video of drive-by shootings. We had pictures of people slinging dope in the middle of the street. And, you know, I had this realization that this wouldn't happen if the council member lived here.
Anne in Old Town East, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi, hi, Jonathan. I just wanted to make a comment to give an example of how the city council has not been helping us, and that was the Dispatch article recently about the slum landlords. And I remember that in the article it said that they had already written about this in 1994. Nothing was done. Now, finally, I don't know how many years later, 20 years later, something is being done, or they say there's something going to be done. But we've been complaining about this for years in our inner-city neighborhoods, and I feel that award system would have brought a lot of attention to this issue sooner than now if we'd really had one instead of these large representation.
Okay.
That's what my comment. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Ann. Joe Hallett?
First of all, let me say, I think, again, I'll reiterate that I think the city runs well under the current system, but Jonathan, I think, has a very reasonable proposal as far as so many four at large and, what, seven?
Seven from districts, yeah.
And I don't want to suggest that that won't work as well, mm-hmm. but I was curious, Jonathan, whether you think that it would benefit the city to go to a nonpartisan primary system, such as they have in
like
California.
Like a runoff type of?
Yeah, where the top two, the top mm-hmm. four, regardless of party, in fact, they wouldn't be identified by party on a primary ballot, advance to the general election, or whether you believe that it probably wouldn't matter because the Democrats will have so much money.
It's down to the money again. Uh-huh.
Yeah. I mean, technically, we do have nonpartisan elections under our city charter, and party affiliation is not on the general ballot, as you know. You know, I think whatever the mechanism, what we're proposing is that by offering a Columbus Fair Campaigns Code, one of the things we do is we say there will be some public financing of campaigns. And for people who agree to limits, the public believes it's so important to get good information that we're willing to pay for it, as opposed to you having $16,000 to spread across the city. So I think moving that forward into the primary season, again, you've got to have – we have very strong Democrats who are very interested in it, but they're not going to buck this system where only party appointees get put on council. The Democrats wait their turn, act loyal, and hope to get an appointment. The last 28 years, we've only had three council members who were elected prior to beginning service. Everybody else is appointed and then runs as an incumbent, now runs as an incumbent with the council president's money. And we've got to do better than that.
There's one thing before we let you go, because we do have to take a break. Jonathan Beard, you want to restore city funding for public access television.
Absolutely.
Why is that a component of Dare to Be Fair?
It all gets to do with this ideas in the public marketplace that we should be able to have more than one view of life in Columbus, that there should be competing views, that people should be free. Most big cities have public access TV. It's where any citizen can get on and, you know, publicize anything from a birthday party. There are a lot, I think 30% of it before was religious programming. But the idea is that the people should have a voice. The federal communications law, there's a public access TV, there's an education TV, and then there's government TV. We've got education and government run by those entities, but no voice of the public. It was defunded about 10 years ago, seemingly under budget cuts. There's absolutely no reason the public should not have their TV. What they show now is this blue screen of rotating church services on Channel 21, and that's an embarrassment. It's disrespectful to the public. The public should be able to have its voice on mass media. Media consolidation is a huge issue. Couple that with the political consolidation that we've got. And, you know, essentially we are being disenfranchised from bringing our views to the marketplace. So,
well, thank you for bringing your views to the show today.
Thank you, Anne. It's a pleasure.
Appreciate it. John Beard, he's spokesperson for the Columbus Coalition for Responsive Government. We'll have a link on our website to that organization at WOSU.org/allsides. Joe Hallett will stay with us. Coming up, we're going to hear from Daniel DeSalvo. He's a professor of political science at City University of New York. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about one-party rule. It's been the norm in Columbus City government for a long time. Joining us now by phone to consider the trend across the country is Daniel DeSalvo. He is the Colin L. Powell School from the Colin L. Powell School for Civic and Global Leadership at City College of New York. Welcome to the show, Dan.
Hi, it's my pleasure to be with you.
You've written that one-party rule has been the norm in urban America for a long time. How long? What are we talking about there?
Well, you could say most of the 20th century, or even most of since the Civil War, the cities have a strong tendency to really become all one thing or all the other. That is to say, all Republican or all Democratic. That's not to say that there can't be intermittent points when, say, the opposite party comes in and can be competitive. I mean, we can think recent years in a city like New York. Rudy Giuliani and an independent Republican, Michael Bloomberg in a heavily Democratic city, or in Richard Rorty in Los Angeles.
Does the question of wards versus open seats have anything to do with it?
Well, I think just to think back a little bit on these basic structures, the hard thing about political parties in cities is that cities tend to be very transactional in their politics. Groups are seeking to get things, and they're pretty narrow and small things, licenses, abatements, and they're not often issues about what to do about food trucks. They're not often issues that fit neatly into the party's general policy positions, whereas on the national level, voters can see, oh, the Democrats are for a more active government and generally favor that, whereas the Republicans are for a smaller or reduced government. On the local level, politics tends to be less principled and more transactional, and that makes it hard for people to use political parties as a device to sort out candidates and their positions, regardless of the institutional mechanisms, wards versus something else that you mentioned.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking to Dan DeSalvo from the City College of New York, and also with us, Joe Hallett, senior editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Dan, what about the process in Columbus by which a vacant seat on city council must be filled by someone who will run for office? So there's a vacancy, then there's an appointment, and that person must run, and they're usually supported by the person who ended up appointing them.
Mm-hmm. As a mechanism, clearly that gives the person who's running a significant advantage. They're appointed, their name gets out in public, they have higher name recognition potentially than a challenger. They're probably in some sense loyal to the mayor that appointed them to that office. So in that sense, you're looking at consolidating a kind of party position, or at least some kind of loyalty between the mayor and someone on the city council.
For many years, Republicans dominated the landscape in Columbus. Now Democrats seem to have city government in a headlock. Is that the way it's worked across the country, that they're consolidating at the urban level like this across the country?
Well, you can see that there's been changes. You could say that from, say, the and most of the 20th century, for example, Republicans dominated in Philadelphia. Then really beginning in the 60s, there was a shift, and ever since, Democrats have dominated in Philadelphia. So as I suggested, you know, it's in part because cities have this tendency to become all things, all one party or all the other. Mm-hmm. If you look at Oklahoma City today, a city that's you know, vibrant and growing, Republicans tend to be the dominant party there.
Let's hear from Steve in Columbus. You're on the air, Steve.
Yes, good morning. Just where would the Republican district be in Columbus if there was one?
Joe Hallett, is it really about that there would be a Republican district?
I don't think so. I don't think that there are a lot of – there are areas, obviously, I think, in the north, particularly in the northern part of the city, where you could carve out Republican districts if you wanted to. I don't think that if we went to a ward system, they would be determined – wards would be drawn by partisan makeup. I think they would probably be drawn more – by making sure that the districts are compact and contiguous and maybe even competitive.
Kind of the way that the redrawing of legislative and congressional districts is supposed to be done?
Supposed to be done is the operative word.
Sorry for that. But it's more about a variation of theme on Democrats. It's not about Republicans or Democrats.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, like... Dan mentioned this, like most major cities now, is pretty handily Democrat, and it's unlikely that Republicans will ever become a majority on council. That I think they would have a much better chance of getting members, Republican members of council, if we went to a ward system. It looks like it's going to be a Democratic city for many years to come.
Steve, thanks for that call. Well, let's talk about the whole idea of the relationship between how legislative and congressional districts are drawn and one-party government in a place like Columbus, where the council seats are all at large. Is there any relationship, Dan DeSalvo, between that, or is it harder for somebody moving up through a city government to get the promotion into the state house or Congress from there?
Well, I'd say I think on the Republican side, I'd make 2 points. First, I mean, partly one of the reasons cities tend to become all one thing or the other is partly the positions of their parties on the national stage. Right now, the Republican Party, you know, favors a smaller government that's taxes less, intervenes less in the marketplace and in the economy. However, cities, really, what's politics about in cities? It's about government doing stuff, providing services, whether that's fire, police protection, and so on. So there's a bit of a translation problem between, say, Republicans in urban areas as they want to move up from, say, cities to the state level and eventually to the national level. The Democratic Party has an easier time with this translation from local to national because the Republican or the Democratic Party nationally favors more active government, and that way they can easily champion such things at the urban level. That said, I think you know, in response to the other caller, Republicans still even if they're not in the majority, can still play a very salutary role in cities, as we've seen some examples in New York, Los Angeles, Indianapolis, and elsewhere.
Joe?
I wonder, Professor, if you've been able to make any judgments through your study, or just anecdotally, about what system works better for cities in a large elected council or one with wards. I was mentioning earlier before you came on that I had experience covering politics in Cleveland, which was a city with a mayor and 21 ward members on the council. And as I said, it was a lot more fun to cover because there was a lot more bickering and fighting and parochial interests going on than in a city like Columbus where everybody's elected at large.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's not clear. I mean, the big debate often amongst scholars is whether you have a city manager system versus the strong mayoral system. In part, the city manager systems were meant as a kind of progressive era reform to weaken the power or hold of political parties. And that is to make the elections more nonpartisan in a way that the council, the strong mayor with a city council elected on a district or ward basis, was meant to keep the parties more active or stronger. But the idea of moving away from that to the city manager system was meant as a mechanism to weaken the grip of party machines in cities, which were seen as corrupt and so on. Again, because they're engaged in that transactional politics of, you know, doling out goodies to the favored few.
Columbus is, of the top 50 cities, biggest cities in the nation, the only one that still relies on an at-large, very small number of city council members in an at-large election process. The others are going the other way. I guess Seattle is the last to go to a ward system or a district system. What do you make of that trend? What is pushing that?
Well, but in some cases, in some parts of the country, what's pushing that is at-large districts or at-large electoral systems have become very hard to sustain under the Voting Rights Act for large parts of the country. In other areas, people saw that it just wasn't generating the kind of competition or accountability that people wanted from these elections. I think the biggest issue facing council elections in urban areas around the country is low participation, low engagement, and low turnout in the future. I mean, if you look at New York and Los Angeles in their recent electoral contests, you're looking at, for city councils, participation is below, is around 20% of the electorate.
And by making it at a ward system where there's more to choose from, someone closer to you, someone more local, makes it more interesting for the voters.
It might make it more interesting. I mean, those are situations where it is already that system and you're having low participation. Mm-hmm. So whether you move in one direction or the other, but the idea is that if you're not going to be able to use the party as a mechanism for letting voters sift through the various candidates, at least you can then try to get them to know the person. And this is also a reason that often, because parties are weak devices in cities for people to sort candidates, and it's hard to get to know the names of all the people running for council that people often become in a lot of cities, the way to slice things up becomes race and ethnicity.
What about the question of the number of citizens per member on a city council? Is that relevant in this day and age? In Columbus, it's more than 112,000 versus, say, Indianapolis, where it's 28,000. Granted, that's a metropolitan form of government where it's county and city combined.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very relevant for the kind of, representation per person, and you could say the proximity of the representative to the represented. Clearly, the larger district that you get, the more diluted your representation is and the more distance there is between the elected official and those they're represented. If you only have to represent 30,000 people, it's much easier to get to know the major stakeholders and key players in that district or area.
One of the components of this initiative put forth by this Coalition for Responsive Government, we spoke with Jonathan Beard just before you, is restoring city funding for public access TV. And do you think that that is an important tool in this day and age for a community to have public access television?
Maybe. I would say probably less important than it was in the past, mm-hmm. when the number of offerings on television was far fewer, and where people actually surfed through channels rather than just, using the guide and going directly to the one they want. Especially with the proliferation of the internet and so on, there's just so many more voices and so many more vehicles to disseminate information today than there was, say, 30 years ago when you only had the major networks. That would have been a period where public access television was the vehicle for a genuine alternative voice. Now, with the internet out there and the way people consumed television news and information, I would see it as probably less salient today.
Well, Dan DeSalvo, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it.
My pleasure.
Dan DeSalvo, a political scientist at City College of New York, and Joe Hallett, senior editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Ann.
Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
There's another hour of All Sides with Ann Fisher in just a moment, and be sure to listen to All Sides on Tuesday for the latest kitchen technology, and then how the best damn band in the land has turned to the iPad for some extra on-field glory this season. That's Tech Tuesday tomorrow in All Sides with Ann Fisher from 10 to noon. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Israel's internal and external challenges. We talk with Israeli journalist Ari Shavit about the ongoing peace negotiations with Palestinians, divides between secular and ultra-Orthodox Jews, and his own experiences in the Israeli military. Shavit's new book is My Promised Land. Join us.
Fresh Air later today at noon. And support comes from United Way of Central Ohio. United Way fights poverty, improves lives, and strengthens our community by bringing together people and organizations to address complex local issues in education, income, health, and home. More information is available at liveunitedcentralohio.org. 49 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1 minute before 11 o'clock. A mix of sun and clouds today and a high of 53. Partly cloudy tonight. And a low of 30 degrees. Thanks for joining us. It is 11 o'clock.
That's music from 400 Blows by Francois Truffaut. If you knew that, then the words Criterion Collection probably bring to mind the best foreign, independent, and classic films. Films from directors as diverse as Charlie Chaplin, Truffaut, and even Michael Bay have gotten the so-called Criterion treatment of high-quality digital presentations packed with loads of DVD extras. All this for the discriminating cinematic collector. This hour on All Sides with Dan Fisher, we'll talk about how older films are restored and repackaged in an age of streaming video, and we'll hear what makes the grade in collections such as Criterion. That's after the news on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News and streaming at WOSU.org/allsides.